Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 191 with my guest Matt Oswalt. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code MENTAL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour. Honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's not a doctor's office. I'm not a therapist. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. Check it out. Go fill out a survey. See how other people filled out surveys. Read a blog by me or a guest blog by somebody. Donate to the show. Buy a coffee mug, a t-shirt. Or just run through the meadow. Run through the meadow of the website. Take off your sandals. Feel the breeze in your hair. And run through our website's meadow. Before we get to the episode today with Matt, I want to read you. This is an email I got from a person who calls himself Zingo, and they write, "Listening to your podcast with Aparna, she was my previous guest, Aparna Nancherla. I appreciate what you do and listen every week. It's helped me as I've fought crippling anxiety and self-doubt. Really, it has. Still, you mentioned today a support group where you met three beautiful people who felt bad about themselves. While I appreciate that some of us are trolls, bald, buck-toothed, four-eyed, fat-ass trolls. That's fine. I've come to terms with it. I've come to terms with people thinking I'm a creep for doing no more than being. I understand how pretty people can feel bad about themselves, but still, man, I hope they know how envious us uglies are." Thank you for that, Zingo. This is Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Quarter Life, and about her depression. She writes, "One day I realize I haven't done anything fun or spoken to any friends in 2 months. I freak out, make an effort for a little bit, then it happens again." And a snapshot from her life. "I'm at work. I think about maybe going out and doing something, maybe alone, maybe texting a friend. Instead, I go home thinking I'll maybe do some laundry or clean up or do some writing or an art project or read a book or. And then suddenly it's 1 a.m. and I've been online for hours, most likely high. Nothing has gotten done. I haven't even packed lunch for tomorrow. Then I go to bed, oversleep, get to work late, and repeat." Oh my God. I bet so many people just felt like a jolt go through themselves, like, holy shit, that is me. That would be me if I had a 9-to-5 job. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. This is, I love this guy's name for himself. He calls himself, "I done broke my brain." And about his love addiction, he writes, feels like constantly chasing a mirage through the driest desert on earth, knowing full well the chase will kill me. About his codependency, my significant other talking to another man is like the 9/11 of daily events. And a snapshot from his life. On line one, I had the police telling me to get her to come home, while on line two, I had her telling me she took an overdose and didn't want to die. Second girlfriend with diagnosed borderline personality disorder. And then this one is from Terry, and she writes about her OCD. I probably think about cancer 100 times a day. I've never been diagnosed with cancer, but I still fight it.
Oh God, I wish I didn't need to take meds.
Flat out fucking auditory hallucinations. I would literally wake up running from my bed.
I'm afraid that I'll pass my anger on to my son.
I thought the gunman was my father.
Afraid of not being able to make a living.
That's probably going to break his heart if he hears it, but that's the truth.
They committed him to Bellevue.
There was this fear that if I feel this pain,
I wish someone could see what was going on and just help me,
that it will kill me and I will die and I will drown.
You can't think your way out of a thinking problem.
And I cried the way that a baby cries. Cried like an animal.
It makes me so mad at myself that I do that.
The burden of perfectionism.
And that's when I got into therapy.
Let's talk about that. Because I was like, fuck it, I'm alive. I don't give a shit about anything.
You are a shining example of what is best about human beings.
I'm worried that the Russian militia is coming over the hill.
I know that, but Alice, how you feeling?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good.
I'm here with Matt Oswalt, who, what would you be best known for? The Puddin'?
Yeah, Puddin', okay. Is sort of a thing that I do with Eddie Pepitone.
Former guest.
Oh, really? He's been on here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my Lord. It was like a 10-hour show or something. He seems like the kind of guy that could talk a lot on a show like this. Like, he'd be a perfect guest.
He was a great guest.
But, Puddin' is what I'm best known for, I guess. This little web series I did with Eddie.
You're originally from the Virginia area?
Yeah, I'm from Sterling, Virginia, a little suburb outside of Washington, D.C. I was just back there recently visiting the family, so it's grown up. I get lost when I go around there now because the area has just exploded. Suburbia and tech and all these giant companies. When I was there, it was just cornfields. That's all it was. Yeah. So.
You and I don't really know each other. We met once at, I think it was at Jimmy Dore's. Jimmy Dore was doing a show at the place next to the Improv.
Oh, yeah, space. Yeah. Well, he was doing it with Eddie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. Okay.
Yeah.
It was, that was the old, what was it called? The Improv, it's like a space
Improv
next
Lab?
To, Improv Lab, yeah, which is no longer there. But that,
oh, it's not?
No, it's been replaced by this... kind of this shishi high-end bar that's part of the Improv, but it's like it's built up.
Oh, I was hoping it was either going to be a greedy bank or a pharmacy.
Or a Starbucks, which seemed to be the perfect kind
the
of...
The only thing that that people are building these days.
The only thing that lasts...
And rehabs.
And rehabs. Lots of those, yeah.
So where would be... one of the reasons why I asked you to be a guest on the show was... Was it your description on Twitter? Do you mention depression on your description on Twitter?
Oh, well,
or had you
self-deprecation
tweeted?
Is sort of my running theme on my Twitter account. So if you follow me on Twitter, it's all inward stuff. And I think that's probably what you noticed and was like, this is the kind of guy that would be perfect for my podcast.
Let's bring that loathing.
All of his tweets are about nooses and putting his head in the oven driving off a pier. And so, he's a perfect guy for my podcast.
Well, let's start from the beginning. How many kids in your family? And I know your brother
it's
and some
just
people.
Me and my brother, my older brother. That's it. That's
Patton,
it.
Patton Oswalt,
yes.
Who
yes.
A lot of people may be familiar with.
He was the third lead on King of Queens. Not sure if you guys out there watched that show. Very excited for his success. Not sure what he's done since, though. I've not really followed his career since then, so I'm not sure. But,
What was and it's interesting because you used to play hockey, you were a jock, you're tall.
Still a jock.
Yeah. Still play sports.
Oh yeah, yeah. Racquetball, tennis, golf, and I big runner, I find that exercise chases away the blues. I think there's two kinds of depressed people. Those who veg out in front of the TV all day and those who need to get out and go for long hikes in Griffith Park by themselves, just them and the coyotes. And thank God I'm one of those kind of depressing people, you know?
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine. I know people. I have a lot of writer friends, and all writer friends are, you know, depressed. So,
sedentary.
And they they sit around the house all day watching extreme couponing marathons and eating lots of Hot Pockets. And I've never really gone that route. Usually when I feel bad, the worse I feel, the more I exercise. So
wow, you're lucky.
I'm, you know, a manic depressive with six-pack abs, ladies. You know, so.
Have you been diagnosed with manic depression?
No, I was just making, okay. No, that's part of my humor.
All right.
What is manic? I don't know what that is.
Manic depressive would be somebody who has extreme highs and extreme lows.
Okay.
And there's two, there's bipolar one and bipolar two. It used to be called manic depression, and now it's called bipolar disorder.
Oh, okay.
And bipolar 1 is much more intense than bipolar 2.
Okay.
Bipolar 1 are people that tend to have to be, you will see hospitalizations in,
really?
In their, I heard somebody to say one time, there's two types of bipolar, the kind of bipolar that gets you promoted and the kind of bipolar that gets you fired.
Makes sense. Yeah. Do you have any of these? I'm curious. I don't even know anything about
you. I've had periods of mania, but my psychiatrist doesn't believe that that I am bipolar. He thinks I maybe near it, but no,
you never crossed that line. Yeah.
No, the only times I've experienced mania is when I've switched meds, and there will be a brief period, sometimes a couple of days, sometimes a couple of months. And where I get very compulsive about things. But I've never, like, you know, gone 2 days without sleep. Bipolar 1 people, you'll see when they're in their mania, they'll go, like, on very little sleep.
Really?
And start
projects
that are just insanely
complex.
They're,
like, writing operas at, like, 2 in the morning. And, like, you know, I'm gonna rebuild the Louvre in Legos in my basement. You know?
talking nonstop. Very agitated if people disagree with them.
Mm-hmm.
Friend after friend asking, are you okay? And they begin to think that everybody's just kind of jealous of them because they're, you know, got life by the balls.
Wow.
And then when that goes away, the crushing low comes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I think my depression is kind of flatline. It just kind of blah. I get the blahs, you know? Yeah. And it's, but I get those little mini panic attacks. I get those, but I think those sort of go with it though. I'll get like they're not a lot, maybe once a week I'll be like, I'll kind of find myself in a moment where I'm like, oh my God, I'm unemployed. I'm 43. I blah, blah, blah. And I just had this like crushing, like, you know, episode of just heavy breathing. And then it goes away after a couple of minutes, you know.
Are you the, older or the younger?
The younger. Patton's about 2 years older than I am.
And when the anxiety attacks come, what are they about stuff specific, or is it just a general anxiety?
It's just a, you know, it's almost like I find myself completely aware of the moment. Like I just said, I'll suddenly just say to myself, I'm 43 years old. I don't have a girlfriend. I'm not working right now. In this huge crushing like realization of where I am right now, and I just sort of like think about it for like a few seconds, and it like freaks me out, and then it goes away because I realize, you know what, there's nothing wrong with being 43 and not having a girlfriend or not having the career that you wanted. I mean, 99% of the world is like that, so then it goes away. But they still come every once in a while.
Yeah, and you know, my thought is you share that is. You're in the moment in a way, but in a way you're also, the fear is really about projecting. Because in that moment, you're okay. You're not hungry. You're not in physical pain.
Yeah.
It's really fear of the future.
You think so?
Yeah, because if you really break it down, you're, this is just my opinion, but your fear is you're projecting this moment into the future. So you're not really being present. If you were really being present, you would say, how does my body feel right now? I have food in my belly. I have friends.
That makes sense. Yeah,
you know, I'm okay. I'm breathing. I'm upright, and that's what I try to do. Is I try to keep it in today, and that's like sometimes that's even future projecting. Sometimes I just try to keep it right now. And when people say, "Hey, how you doing?" I say, I'm just trying to keep it in today. Right here, right now, I'm okay.
Because
the future is a fucking dangerous neighborhood.
It's a terrifying world to even think about sometimes, you know?
Yeah, I think especially if we're prone to depression, because we extrapolate that and we think, I'm going to have the blues or the blahs forever, or this moment of reprieve that I have is going to be short-lived.
Wow.
And then that's ruined.
Yeah.
The brain is ingenious at shitting.
The brain will find a way to fuck you up, whether you want to or not.
That's like a sprinkler.
It's okay to say fuck on your podcast, right? I'm not sure if you're allowed to say fuck on the internet. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Depression is like a sprinkler system of diarrhea will just make sure every corner of the lawn is covered.
Wasn't that 30 Seconds to Mars' last album a sprinkler of diarrhea? Wasn't that the album title? I thought I could have sworn. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong here.
But it was quite an album cover.
I don't
cover.
Follow the young people's music that much anymore, so I could be wrong. But, yeah, that's that makes a lot. But I just going back, I just think it's just these moments of realization, and they usually happen around 2 p.m. as I'm eating a hot dog bun smothered in grape jelly over my sink, glancing at an ITT tech brochure, and like, what the fuck? And then it all hits me, you know?
And then you're projecting into how your career is actually going to go in ITT tech.
Yeah. Thinking, you know what, I could actually give the writing thing just to walk away from it and maybe get into airplane repair or something. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. A lot of good jobs in that. I've
occasionally thought about growing weed again for money, but I couldn't. I never sold it, but I was very good at it. It was the late 80s, but that's another story entirely.
Wow. If you moved to Colorado, if only you lived in Colorado, you could be maybe like a weed, icon guy, because you'd know all the ins and outs of how to grow it and how to sell it. And now that it's legal there, you could be like, this kingpin.
And those guys are making so much money. Now they're like legal.
I've heard they're not making as much as you think, because it costs so much to grow it and maintain, and then taxes are insane.
Oh, are they?
And so they make a lot on paper, but at the end of the day, after all the costs, it's not as much as you think. I've heard that. Not that they're complaining, because they get to, be around weed all day. But I'm just saying that I've heard that the people who are into it, it's a really tough business.
I saw this thing on Vice, that HBO series.
Yes, I know Vice.
And the guy who's one of the biggest growers there was making so much money, or at least grossing so much money.
Yeah.
He had to have a security follow him to the bank. Much like a drug cartel, which I thought was interesting. He's got this caravan
of black limos, just taking cash to the bank.
But
was this in Colorado?
It was in Colorado.
Okay.
Yeah. But I digress. Let's go back and talk about your childhood. What was that like? Oh, were you childhood?
What kind of podcast is this? I just want to promote my gig at the Improv next week and get the hell out of here. My childhood. It was actually a very Norman Rockwell-ish childhood. Suburbia, woods to play in, a lot of neighborhood kids. We played football in the front yard, and great Halloweens. I remember the Halloweens the most. I was in one of those neighborhoods where everyone went nuts for Halloween, so it was haunted houses everywhere and trick-or-treating, and it was just the best. And white Christmases, and so I don't have any like horrible complaints about, aside from all the sexual abuse, but that's another podcast. But
that was rollicking.
That was rollicking. No sexual abuse, in case my mom and dad are listening. No, it was just a very idyllic childhood. I had no...
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we get a lot of listeners who feel extra fucked up because they have the blues or they have depression and they have nothing in their life that they can point to. And there's a lot of people. And I think there's kind of two categories of those people. I think there's people who haven't confronted something yet because something is buried, or, or they didn't realize that if not a subtle abuse in their household, there was indifference, which just felt normal to them. Yeah. And then there's other people where truly there was nothing bad, where it was truly idyllic.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for both of those people to hear somebody else share that lack of trauma, that lack of an event to point to, so they can know it doesn't... Yeah, the past can be worth exploring, but don't wait to get some nugget, some aha nugget, to try to move forward and process what you're feeling and to have empathy for yourself.
You know, one thing about my childhood that I will admit to, and this is something my therapist and I talk about a lot, is I had a good friend growing up, my next door neighbor, but he was a year older than I was. But it doesn't matter when you're 5 and 4. But as we went to school, my parents thought, oh, it'll be cute, and Matt and his friend go to school together. So I was enrolled in kindergarten like a year younger than I should have been. I was the youngest kid in class by far. And even the teachers were like, you know, I think you should wait a year before putting, but they're like, oh no, it'll be cute. He and his best friend next door, they want to go to school together and it'll be so blah, blah, blah. And in kindergarten, I got by because I was a pretty bright kid. But by the time I got to fifth grade, it was clear that I was kind of falling behind a little bit. And the teachers and my parents had this big conference. They kind of said, hey, before we move him on to middle school, I think he needs to stay back here for one. I think he's way too young. He's just too young. I think I was almost a year and a half younger than everybody in my class, which is just insane. And so they decided to pull me back for a year. And that was really traumatic because I was left back, not because I was getting all F's, not because I was a bad student, just because I was too young and I didn't understand. I couldn't understand that. So
it felt like failure.
The next year, when all my best friend and all my friends that I'd made were going on to junior high, I was going to school at the same school as I was for another year with all these kids that I thought I was older than because they were a year young. They were a grade less than I was, and now they're all on my level. Mm. And this is something that my parents have always regretted because they never really explained it to me. They didn't articulate to me the reasons of why I was left behind. And it really fucked me up because I kind of lost some of the friends that I had made. My best friend and I kind of drifted apart because he began, you know, hanging out with older kids. And we kind of drifted apart and I had a hard time adjusting. And that was a real significant moment in my life, I think, because it's made me very cautious about making friends. I've always been very slow about that. I'm very personable and amiable, but you know, I've always been slow about making friends with people because I always have this weird feeling that they're going to leave me after a year or so, which is what happened with me and my best friend. But a lot of my bullshit kind of goes back to that. My therapist and I have talked about it a lot. At this moment in fifth grade when I was left behind, it was a significant moment. And, you know, and I changed too because before that, I was a pretty good kid. And I'll admit, when I got left back, I became kind of a shithead. I was suspended a lot and I started getting into my little early 80s heavy metal scene and growing the hair long and wearing the jean jacket with Lynyrd Skynyrd on the back. And I was turning into that kind of kid. And I got suspended a couple times. I got in trouble. You know, I turned into that guy. And I think a lot of it was because I was lashing out because I was embarrassed. I was hurt. I was confused. And nobody was giving me the answers, you know? And so I think a lot of my stuff goes back to that. And I think that eventually as I got older, I think I just pushed it back. I just pushed it down. I never really talked about it with anybody. But I think it was a significant moment, you know?
Were you able to make friends eventually in your
Yeah, I was. But I was, but they were never the same kind of friends. They were people that I kind of held. They were friends, but they were people that I would hold at a distance. Like, for instance, I graduated high school in 1989, I don't talk to anybody from that high school. I think the year after I graduated high school, I'd moved on to college, and I just didn't talk to any of my friends from high school ever again. And, you know, I never even thought about it. I don't even, like, every once in a while, somebody will, like, send me a Facebook request. It's like some old guy from high school. I don't even, like, accept it. I don't want to deal with it, you know? It's just like that part of my life's over, and I just move on. And it's just something that it really just shows that even though I had friends after that, they were never close friends, you know? It was never a close friendship like me and my best friend, you know, next door neighbor had before the whole fifth grade thing happened.
And so you two drifted apart.
Yeah, we drifted apart, and eventually he moved. He moved about 2 years after he went ahead of me, and we just never really talked again. So, yeah. Okay, Dr. Phil, thanks. I'm depressed now. Thanks a lot. For those of you not knowing, I'm literally crying as I'm talking right now. Paul is wiping tears that are streaming down my face, and we're hugging. And just to give you a visual of what's going on right now.
We do have moments of that.
You do, really? You've had people cry?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that. Have you ever cried on the podcast?
Oh, yeah.
You have?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Who made you cry? Like, who was in here that made? I'm curious now.
There was an episode with Lin Chen. I was going through some difficult stuff, and she was sharing some stuff that had happened to her that was similar, and I just felt this kinship with her.
Sure.
And recovering from, you know, abuse sometimes can be really non-linear. And moments will catch you off guard.
Yeah.
And it just caught me off guard, and I couldn't stop crying, and I just was craving a hug from her. And so I said, would it be okay with you if we paused here for a second? And I just got a hug from you, because I just need to let these tears out, because I felt like it was going to bog the podcast down.
Yeah.
And it felt great. And and then we were, you know, we picked up and we finished recording. And I shared it with the listeners when I did the intro to the podcast. I said, here's what happened. And I was feeling shame about it. I was feeling like I was making it all about me. But one of the things I've realized doing this podcast is sometimes there's moments when you got to listen to what you're feeling. It's hard to know when you're making it all about you or when you're just embracing the hurt part of your soul.
Well, sometimes things affect you in a certain way and you have to make it a little bit about you. I mean, after all, this is your podcast and it all kind of comes back to you eventually. You know, you're the vessel of this whole thing. So if somebody says something that personally affects you, I assume your audience who's listened to you for a long time, they know what you're going through. They can probably sense that and then go, okay, she's hit on a topic that I bet Paul's, you know.
I think the difficulty is when you have a negative voice in your brain that's been there your whole life, is you're giving it some great ammo to say, you know, to roll its eyes and go, oh, Jesus, here we go again. You know, wah, 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 wah.
Yeah.
And the feedback that I've gotten from listeners over the 3 years of doing this podcast is they share that they have the same voice in their head. So that kind of lets me know that, oh, this is a thing. This is one of the ways that the darkness presents itself, is that it will tell you that you're a baby, you're an exaggerator, and you're doing this for attention. And so I try to remember that when my instinct is to put myself down for expressing what I'm feeling, or to say, hey, I really need to talk about myself right here, because I'm struggling. And as we all know, like you did, burying those feelings, it's not going to go away. It's just going to come out in a different form.
It's my nature. It's my family's nature. We bury things.
And you're going to start wearing a Skinner jacket, and that doesn't help anybody.
And having a wallet with one of those chains on it, you know, like, oh God, that was bad. Hey. By the way, my Twitter handle, you follow me on Twitter. It's very self-deprecating, and it's, I'm not going to say it's a cry for help, but it's what you just said. It reminds me of what you just said. I use self-deprecating humor as a defense, as my brand of comedy. And I hope that it's funny. I'm glad that it's funny, but it's also there's a little bit of truth in a lot of that stuff.
What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, it's at Puddinstrip, PUDDINSTRIP. Mm-hmm. Puddin, like a hick would spell it, right, as Eddie Pepitone would say.
Why is that a cry for help?
Oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't say cry for help, but there are moments where I'm like, I'm at home on a Saturday night and I'm not doing anything and I got no date and I'm just hanging out eating, you know, Crunch and Munch and watching, you know, like an old movie, and I get a little sad and I start tweeting, and my tweets are funny, but they're also very self-deprecating. Yeah. They're also very self-deprecating, and people retweet them and favor them a lot because it's funny, but it's also like there's a little bit of truth in
a lot
of stuff.
There's a sadness.
There is. There's a sadness,
and a longing to belong or connect inside there.
Sure.
When you're at your darkest, loneliest, most negative moments, if you could put aside any fear of judgment by anybody or judging by yourself, what would you want to open the window and scream out to the universe?
Putting aside judgment.
You judging yourself, anybody else hearing it and judging you, just an anonymous scream to whatever created the universe,
you know,
as in charge of how things
are
unfolding.
I would probably and I hope this doesn't sound, this is going to be negative, I would probably scream help, because it's something I never do. I'm very inward, and I'm very, I push things down, and I never, ever express myself. I can be kind of cold, and it's something I'm not comfortable doing. And I think in a lot of ways, it's the reason that my career hasn't gone where I thought it would, because in this town, you have to be very pushy with people. And I don't come from that. I have a very hard time pushing myself on people and asking of favors and asking of stuff. And it's just something I've never been comfortable with. So any kind of, so I think the word help for me, it would be significant because it's something I never asked for. And if I could put aside all the stuff that you just talked about and able to free up, that's probably why I would, you know, because it's something I've never asked anybody.
It was really, really hard for me to ask for help. But, you know, you asked for help in a way. You went to therapy.
I was forced into that. Yeah, I was kind of, I didn't want to go. My family, I opened up to my family a little bit about how I was feeling. And this all happened after a bad bike accident that I was in. And I was recovering from it, but I wasn't recovering from it. And I was not returning phone calls. I think I went like a month and I didn't talk to my family at all. And they were kind of like, is he dead? Is he like swinging from a noose in his apartment? Or we're going to like, you know, and finally I got in touch with them and we just had a long talk. And I think I was just so down. It was clear that I was just down, that you could see it from a mile away. And we talked about it. And I opened up about how I was getting suicidal and blah, blah, blah. And they've sort of said, you need to go to therapy and, you know, you need to at least make a try. Cause I was at the end of my rope, I think. You know, this was when I was 39 years old.
When you say bike, you mean motorcycle or bicycle?
Bicycle. I was a big biker. I told you earlier that I'm a big exerciser, and one of the things I did was I would take these long bike trips, like from my place in Hollywood, I'd go to Santa Monica, to Manhattan Beach, to Huntington Beach. I'd take these day trips. I'd go to Malibu. I just went everywhere. I loved it. It was a great thing. And one morning, I was on my way to Muscle Beach or something. I used to go to Venice a lot and watch them play basketball. But I was going down there, and I was going up Santa Monica Boulevard on my bike, and I hit a sewer grate, and my tire wedged into it. Like, so I was going pretty fast. And
you went over the bars?
And when I went, I stopped suddenly. I went right over the bars, and I went mouth first right into the pavement of Santa Monica. And I was out for like a second and a half. And I just remember opening my eyes and seeing pavement and blood and teeth. And I was like, oh, shit. And I popped up immediately, and I was just like in a state of shock. And some guy happened to be standing there, and he's like, don't worry, I called 911. I'm like, no, I don't need 911. He goes, no, you need 911. And I looked down, and just blood is just pouring out of my mouth. And I had severed my lip like down the middle and to the side, so my entire lip was like kind of hanging off like my face, like, you know, it was pretty bad. And I was in shock. Clearly, I was in shock because I didn't know what had happened. And I just stood there for a second, and an ambulance came by, and they put me on the gurney and drove me to the hospital. I just remember being in the ambulance talking about football the entire time. The guy was a big Eagles fan. I had an Eagles shirt on, so he was like, we were talking about like Michael Vick and all that shit the whole entire time. And got to the hospital, and they stitched me up. I think it was about, they lost count at around 200 stitches, and lost teeth. I broke my nose. Let me see, I broke both my orbital bones. I broke my jaw in two places. I had a cracked skull. I had a major concussion, and I had a pinched C5 nerve down my right shoulder, which was, it made my right arm pretty much numb. I couldn't use it for like a month. It was just numb. And the C5 is exactly what happened to Christopher Reeve. And the doctor who talked to me said, if you had hit with about a couple more pounds of foot pressure, you would have broken your neck. So he goes, you're very lucky to have walked away from this, because I rarely see C5, you know, pinched nerves, so that doesn't also include a broken neck. So he goes, you were very lucky. And so that was bad. My brother,
you know, in looking at your face right now,
you wouldn't see it, yeah.
I can't tell. Now that you mention it, I see the scar from your lip, but when you walked up, I was like, oh, this, here's a handsome,
the guy did a good
handsome
job.
Young man.
Well, the guy did a good job. He swung me up. He was, he did a really good job. And, yeah. And it's kind of a Harrison Ford kind of chin scar. I kind of like it now. It's kind of, you know, masculine, I think. You know, I like it. It's kind of, I kind of dig it. It's my first cool scar.
So are those all fake teeth?
The whole bridge, yeah. These are, I lost my two front teeth. And so this is a bridge right here. It's like the two teeth next to the front teeth, and the front teeth are all fake. But it's welded in there. It's going to be there for the next 50 years. It's fine.
Did you have Jennifer Beals weld it?
Jennifer Beals, oh my God. Wow, I love that. Is that
I
is
like
that a 30-year-old
reference.
Oh,
yeah.
Wait, what did I say? Footloose? What movie am I thinking of?
Flashdance.
Oh, Flashdance. Why did I say Footloose?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Ariel from Footloose. I don't know why I went there for some reason. Yeah, Flashdance.
I heard somebody make a joke one time, speaking of 30-year-old references, about the movie Punchline. You ever see it?
I've seen the movie Punchline, about comedy.
Just so misrepresentative.
And yeah.
Some comic had a joke. He said, Punchline is the comedy what Flashdance is to welding.
I love, my favorite part of Punchline that all my comic friends hate is that there's like an actual like locker room.
Oh,
with lockers.
That was the part that drove us all crazy.
Like what?
Just
hell?
Annoyed us to no end. Yeah.
Well, what annoyed me was that Barry Sobel should be judging any sort of comedy contest. And that's what annoyed me the most. But anyway, so the bike accident happened and, I recovered, and the worst part about it was the next day. See, the day it happened, it was okay because I was all morphined up, and I didn't know what I was doing.
Probably in shock.
And shock, and I was just like, blah. And I woke up the next day, and I looked in the mirror, and by now my face had all puffed up, and I just looked like the Elephant Man. I did not recognize myself at all. And seeing the missing teeth were like really just, it's awful to see yourself with like two missing teeth. It's like, I've had those teeth my whole life, and now they're just on the pavement in Santa Monica being run over by, you know, some asshole in a fucking Hummer right now. So I was just like freaked out, and I was, and at that point I was already kind of depressed, but this just sent me into like a really horrible depression.
Did you have health insurance?
Nope. No health insurance, but I was lucky because I didn't have health insurance. I wasn't working at the time. I ended up filing for something, some sort of Medicare thing, and they paid for the whole thing. Not the teeth. The teeth cost me about $15,000. That all that cost about $15,000. But the health, everything was free.
The hospital visits and all
everything,
that.
And it came free to about $80,000. So it was all.
Did you have to go to like a shitty county hospital? Or?
No, I went to Cedars.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I went to Cedars, and I. And the bill started coming, and it was about $80,000, and I was freaked out, and I applied for this thing you can do if you're, like, unemployed in California, and, like, a hardship thing, and they accepted it. And all I had to pay for was the ambulance ride, which was, like, $430-some, and then the teeth. But everything else was paid for. And it was, I mean, they took a CAT scan on me, and it was, CAT scan's, like, $25,000.
What?
And it took, like, it took about 10 seconds to do this thing. I zipped in there, quick CAT scan, zipped out, and that was it. $25,000. And
what?
Yeah, I know. It's insane. It's insane. They wanted me to spend the night, and I was like, no, I got to get out of here. So I just took off. And I remember I threw up in my brother's car, his brand new Lexus, because all the morphine, it was like, when you're like laying down, they shoot up all that. And when you sit up, it just gets in your stomach, and it makes you really queasy. And so I'm driving home, and I just puked all over his brand new Lexus. I'm sorry. He's like, don't worry.
How did he react? Because I know
he was
great. Pat,
he came right to he came right to the hospital. He took a couple of pictures. I'll email you a couple of photos of me in the hospital.
We may
room.
Have to use that for your website.
Absolutely,
photo.
Yeah, sure. Well, I will email them to you as soon as this is over. He snapped a couple of photos of me in the hospital bed, and he was cool. And he took me home.
Did he crack any jokes?
Yeah, I'm sure he did, but again, I was so morphined up, I didn't even, like, you know, I don't know. I think he did a lot of, like, Godfather stuff. Like, I'm sure he did, or maybe some Goodfellas stuff. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. But I was so morphined up, I have no idea what's going on.
Sweet morphine.
He could have brought Weird Al Yankovic with him, and I wouldn't have even remembered it. Yeah. It was just so messed up. And so, so the next morning I wake up, and my face is, like, you know, Quasimodo, and it was one of those concussions where if I laid back to sleep, the whole room would start spinning. So I had to kind of do things slowly. If I wanted to lay down, I had to kind of go slowly. Otherwise, I'd pass out.
And was anybody staying with you?
No, I was by myself. My brother.
Was that safe?
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do? He checked in on me, but he went to the store and got me a bunch of soups and puddings and Jell-Os and
is
stuff.
Is that where pudding came from?
Yeah, no, it's not, but it's not. But that's funny that you mentioned that, but it's not. But because I couldn't chew anything, so I just drank a lot of soup and ate a lot of Jell-O for the next month, and it was bad. The worst part of it was, you know, I obviously, I just was in a my life was just, you know, in turmoil at this point. It was the lowest I've ever been. And I'd forgotten that I had had a meeting with Jimmy Kimmel to write on a show, the Jimmy Kimmel Show, like 3 weeks after the accident. I kind of forgot about it. And the day before the accident, the meeting, his assistant calls me to like remind me, hey, you have a meeting with Jimmy tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, that's right. And I thought to myself, okay, this is good. This is good. I'm going to go to this meeting, and just being around funny people is going to make me feel terrific. And I'm going to get my mojo back, and I'm going to get a job on a show. And I went into this interview. It was, and I went to Jimmy Kimmel's office, and I've never felt so just awful. I looked like I probably wanted to cry. Like, I just was so depressed. All these bills are coming in, and I'm just like so fucking sad. And I walk into his office, and he's in there looking at photos of Cuba Gooding Jr. naked. I guess he had posted some like naked photos of himself on the internet, and he was looking at these photos like laughing and having a good time. And I'm just like, I'm trying to be funny and be personable like my normal self, and I'm just failing miserably. And we just sit across from each other, and I told him about the accident and the medical, and I'm sure I felt like a Make-A-Wish kid. Like, you know, I just was this horribly depressed guy seeing it. I'm trying to like impress him with my jokes and get a job writing, and it was just so sad. And I just like, and I just couldn't get into the meeting, and I could tell he just, I don't know, it just wasn't going very well. So it ended after about 10 minutes, and I just like got the fuck out of there. And it was awful. It was really not good. You know, it's kind of like somebody tells you you have cancer, and then you go to Disneyland the very next day with your family and trying to be all funny. You know, it's just like,
what a great,
you wanted to stay home and just like be, you know,
what a great analogy for it. I was just emailing somebody the other day that when you're around happy people and you're experiencing depression, it feels like your face is trying to bench press 500 pounds.
Exactly. Yeah. Hi, I've brought you to this Chuck E. Cheese to tell you that you have full-blown AIDS. Now let's get, you know, it's like this the worst place I possibly could have been.
And it just reminds you, too, how much you feel like society has left you in its dust.
Oh, God. I mean, if I was in my normal state of joy, I don't even know if it was joy, but I would have been so funny with Jimmy Kimmel. I would have laughed at the naked Cuba Gooding. I would have some good anecdotes and blah, but instead all I did was just complain about my mouth and how much pain I was in, and I'm sure he could just see the weight of sadness on me. I'm sure he could just see it. Yeah, it was obvious. So,
and as much as he wanted to be around that 12 hours a day, he chose not to.
I think I don't want this guy coming here, you know, just sitting in a corner by himself crying while he's supposed to be writing, you know, Justin Bieber jokes for me. I think I'm going to pass on this guy. So,
literally a sack of sad.
A sack of sad.
God, that was bad. So, was there an arc to it? At what point did you begin to get out of it once you started going to therapy?
There was no real arc to it. I guess the bottom was not even Jimmy Kimmel. The bottom was afterwards. I went home and I pretty much just disappeared.
After what?
After Jimmy Kimmel. After I failed miserably meeting with him, I went home and I pretty much just disappeared for a couple months. I didn't return phone calls. I didn't return emails. I just was like a non-person. And finally, it was my family who kept, I think they were getting very worried about me because I just wasn't reaching out to them at all. And finally, my brother kind of confronted me a little bit and said, hey, what's going on? And I explained to him that I feel lost and hopeless and I'm depressed. And the depression won the war, basically. I'm not in a war with depression. It won the war. Okay?
Did you want to not live?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Every day, I was thinking about suicide. Every day. I thought about ways to do it. I thought all I could do was lay in bed and just think about how much better off if I just killed myself every day. It was bad.
And what was keeping you from actually doing it?
Honestly, because I could never go through with it because I have too much love for my family. And I think that killing yourself is the most selfish, worst thing you can do to your family, especially if they have real love for you back. That was something I put it together myself. I just felt like if I just killed myself at 40 and leaving my mom and my dad and my brother to grieve, it would just be the worst thing. It would have ruined their lives. It would ruin their lives. And I couldn't do that. I can't do that. So as much as I talk about it, as much as I talk the game, I would never do it, you know? But thinking about it, and it's still, I still just think thinking about it is still a horrible place to be. if your life is that bad that you're seriously contemplating suicide. It's a time to get help. And so with the help of my brother and my parents, they sort of pushed me into getting a therapist, and I started talking to him. And it was tough at first because I didn't think it was going to work. I didn't think that just chatting with a guy about, you know, shit was going to work. I didn't see it.
Did you dread going to therapy?
I did because I didn't want to. I was the one thing about, I'll tell you about depression is after a while it becomes comfortable and you like being depressed because at least you know who you are and where you are and what you're feeling, you know?
And how the day is going to go.
Exactly. It's very predictable.
And you find your little pockets of comfort.
There's a sense of control in depression because it makes you feel okay about sitting at home all day, watching TV, lying in bed till noon, you know, watching old movies until dawn. It makes you feel like okay about
it. You just described my life.
Jesus.
I go to bed at 5 and I get up at 12:30.
Yeah, really? Do you like watch TCM? Are you a big TCM watcher?
Documentaries on Netflix. But I got up today at 1 o'clock.
I love documentaries.
Got up today at 1 o'clock.
Really?
Yeah, that's normally I get up at 12:30 or 1 o'clock. Okay. But go ahead.
I got up today at 6:30, went to the gym.
Oh,
then went
fuck
for a run.
You.
I know, fuck me, totally. Fuck me, totally. Then got home, was watching a little bit of The Dirty Dozen before I came here. So not a bad morning.
But getting back to it, so you started... going to the therapist, you didn't
think
it was going to help.
Began going to the therapist, and he immediately wanted to put me on Lexapro, and I fought that. I felt like it was just like my life is so bad that what is some fucking pill going to do? What's that going to do? And finally, after about 3 or 4 weeks, he finally talked me into it. I started taking it, and
so was he a psychiatrist?
He's a psychiatrist.
Oh, okay.
Did I say therapist? Are they the same thing? I don't even know.
No,
I don't know.
Therapist generally refers to somebody who does talk therapy but doesn't have a medical degree.
Oh, okay. This guy's a psychiatrist.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. My bad mm-hmm. terminology. Yeah. But then he prescribed Lexapro, and I began taking it, and slowly. But surely it started to work, and I wasn't not depressed, but I wasn't at the bottom of the abyss anymore. I was still, you
the
know,
lows weren't as low.
The lows weren't as low. And I'll say one thing about what. Can I ask what you take? I'm curious what you're.
I take Lamictal, Celexa, and Buspar.
Okay, I just take Lexapro, and I usually take it at night because it helps me sleep. And one of the my biggest problems with depression before this was I had horrible insomnia, and so I do like a 9:30. Lexapro melatonin cocktail, and I'm telling you, it really helps me get down. Because one of my biggest problems, I don't know, I'm sure you have the same thing, is I just, my head goes, I think, mm-hmm. and I think, and I'll lie in bed all night long just thinking of shit, and thinking, and I won't be able to drift off. And the Lexapro helps stop that, helps slow that down so I can focus on just being and hearing birds chirp or hearing the wind, and I can go off and go to sleep. So that was the biggest, I guess, positive to the Lexapro. Wasn't that I was feeling any better, but I was sleeping much better. And that was a significant thing in my life.
That definitely helps. You
that
know, they
really
say,
helps.
They
I mean,
say,
yeah.
I don't know if you've ever heard the acronym HALT, but hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Those are like the three or the four biggest triggers that can send us into a spiral.
Ugh.
And if you can try to deal with those things up front, or at least recognize, okay, that's what's going on here. That's why mm-hmm. I'm snapping or I'm thinking about suicide. You know, what can I do to alleviate
and
that?
The insomnia was really just destroying my life. I mean, I would be up till 5-6 in the morning, and then I'd sleep till 1 or 2 the next day, and I'm like, I can't get my day going because you can't get your sleep cycle going, and you're missing appointments, and you don't want to hang out with anybody because you're just exhausted, and you just can't get your day going, you know? And so it's awful. So that was the one blessing about Lexapro, is that it helped me sleep.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think eventually I increased the dose a couple times. He told me to, and the talking, and it got me feeling a little bit better. And yeah.
So let's take a little pause here and give some love to our sponsors. One of our sponsors is Bulu Box, and grateful for how many episodes of this show they've sponsored. Bulu Box, which is spelled BULUBOX.com, is it's a service that sends monthly boxes for vitamins, supplements, nutritional products for you to try that are right for you and your body. It's $10 a month. It includes free shipping. And if you use our offer code, you get your first
box absolutely free. So you would go to bulubox.com, click on the microphone in the upper left-hand corner, because we're a podcast, and then you would enter the promo code Happy Hour. And some of the stuff that I've had that they carry that I love are the Promax low sugar protein bar. Great thing to have in the car when you're getting hungry. Because I don't know about you, but when I eat anything with sugar in it on an empty stomach, I feel great for about 10 minutes and then I need to take a nap. And the other thing they have is a protein powder that is awesome called Hemp Force Choco Maca. It's a hemp protein superfood that you can make a smoothie out of. But they have literally dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of products for you to sample and choose from. And yeah, check it out. BuluBox.com, promo code Happy Hour. Want to also give some love to Squarespace. I think I've mentioned on the podcast before the Squarespace is it's a website design service, and you design your own website using templates that they have. It's drag and drop. It's super easy. It's you can start with no credit card, a trial, and you can build a website, see if you like it, and then you can decide if you want to pay $8 a month for your site to go live, which is what I did, because I thought if I'm going to talk about this product, I should try it. And it was super simple. I decided I was going to post a website of dog pictures that I've taken, because that was a crazy hobby of mine for a number of years. And so I posted my favorite dog pictures and made a website. And the address for it, if you want to go check them out, is paul-gilmartin.squarespace.com. And I've gotten a lot of really nice feedback from it. And it couldn't have been easier to put that site together. It took me less than an hour. And it's just a great product. They have really good customer support. The website that you design adapts to whatever type of media people are looking at it on. So if they're looking at it on a phone, it will adjust its size to fit the phone. If they're looking at it on an iPad, et cetera, et cetera. So it's great. And they also have an online store available. So yeah, check it out. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MENTAL to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the show. Thank you, Squarespace. Squarespace, better webs. I was going so well. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website.
Do you remember a moment when you kind of metaphorically felt the sun come out?
I really don't. I think that it was a very slow, gradual, there wasn't a eureka moment where I was like, it wasn't like that. I think it slowly, gradually, it made me face the day with a little bit more confidence so I could get up and do things and, you know, and put myself out there a little bit more. It just gives me a little bit of confidence. And my self-esteem, it's very low, don't get me wrong, but it's the little bit of confidence that it gave me. I was able to get out and go to the gym and meet people and actually be a somewhat social, you know.
And there's a momentum to recovery, just like there's a momentum to depression that sure. They can feed on each other. And I always encourage people, you know, take that little baby step towards something to recover, and you'll eventually begin to get some positive feedback from that, be it you won't feel as low or whatever, and that'll make it easier to make that next appointment or to go to the gym the next time or to eat something instead of shitty junk food.
Yeah. Did you have like a eureka moment, or was it for you was the same, was sort of a gradual, like you sort of, you know, kind of slowly come out of it and you just...
The first moment that I felt like, oh, maybe something was wrong with me that was biological was the first time I went on meds. It was before I ever confronted my drinking or anything like that. It was in 2000. And it was the first, the psychiatrist had prescribed Cerazone for me. And it takes about 4 or 5 weeks to kick in. And I was very cynical that anything was going to work.
Yeah.
And I was on the road and I was watching TV in the comedy condo. And it was some MTV reality show about people that were trying to become professional wrestlers.
I watched that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there
tough
was.
Enough.
Yeah.
I know the show.
And this guy was, there was something just kind of inherently lovable and ridiculous about this guy. And I remember laughing out loud. And I went, oh my God, I can't even remember the last time I felt that giggled, that yeah. I giggled.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a eureka moment for me. And it was so small, but it made me realize that, oh, this is what normal people do. This is what they get to experience every day.
Yeah.
And it felt really good because I was like, maybe there's hope for me. Maybe I can be the type of person that giggles.
Yeah. Just can enjoy a moment of levity.
Yeah.
And it can be the most idiotic, insane moment, but it's a moment of levity. And you realize that's really what, you know, you look for, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that meds gives me, is it gives me a chance to be quote-unquote normal.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that meds make you euphoric, and that is not the case at all. They think it's cheating. No, it's like insulin for a diabetic. It just gives you a chance to be on equal footing with somebody that doesn't.
That's what I feel about Lexapro. It doesn't make me happy. It just makes me, you know, be capable of being happy, you know?
Yeah, you still got to do the other stuff.
I still got to do the work. I still got to meet the world halfway, but at least I have a fighting chance this time.
Yeah.
And it comes and goes. There are days when I'm still down, but that's, you know, but not as many. Not as many.
Yeah. So, it's nice to, this sounds ridiculously understated, but it's nice not to think about suicide all the time. What a waste of mental energy to be thinking about that every day. But when you're in that place, wishing it away doesn't do anything.
And there, I will be honest that I'm not saying that I've turned a corner. I still sometimes have those lows when I'm sitting in my apartment and it's 9 p.m. on a Saturday and I'm like, what the fuck? I'm not doing anything. And I'll start going there a little bit, but I won't go there long. And I may take to Twitter and laugh it off with a dumb, you know, self-deprecating joke, which is good, I think, and healthy. Mm-hmm. But so I don't want you to think that I'm totally like not thinking about putting my head in the noose. But you know, but
let's talk about social media for a second.
Sure.
I think we don't talk about that enough. I get these feelings sometimes when, you know, it's 1 a.m. and my usual cocktail of documentaries or reading surveys or
I do the documentaries too, by the way. I do that a lot too.
Oh, it's the best.
I could watch documentaries.
It's like a hug.
Like 24/7.
Like a warm blanket.
So yeah, yeah.
When those aren't working and the emptiness is really gnawing at me and I don't want to engage in stuff that's, you know, compulsive, like looking at pornography or something, I'll go on Twitter or Facebook and I'll post something, but it feels like it almost makes the emptiness worse because I feel a certain, because then I feel like I'm depressed and I'm an exhibitionist. And
that's a good way of putting it.
What are your thoughts on that? Do you ever get sated by going on there?
Twitter is like being a sadness flasher. It's like showing people you're sad, you know, flashing them. You know, it's really what it's like. It's I think that the thing about me, I've been on Twitter for a couple of years, and I think people that follow me know that all my jokes are inward and that they're self-deprecating and they come from a place of loneliness, because my Twitter account is based on Puddin', which was that daily web series I did with Eddie Pepitone, which was very dark and very lonely and very suicidal. I mean, anything coming from Eddie Pepitone is lonely and suicidal, let's face it. But so people were used to that humor. And since we stopped doing Puddin', and I've just taken over the Twitter handle, I just do my own stuff, it's just stayed that in that arena. So people are used to it. So which is why I don't tweet a lot of stuff about, you know, politics or current events. Every once in a while I will, but usually it's just like, you know, just me sitting there in my apartment at midnight thinking about, you know, why I exist, that kind of stuff. But it's always
jerking off to Sylvia Plath.
Jerk, how dare you? How did you know that, by the way? Did you have it written down somewhere?
Well, she was bent over with her head in the oven.
Oh, God. That's right. Wow, what a way to go that is, huh? Rear-ending Sylvia Plath while she's choking on fumes. All right, but Dr. Phil wouldn't have the guts to cover this stuff. What do you... But all my Twitter humor is... it's self-deprecating and it comes from that place. But is it exhibitionist? I don't know, because everyone I think that I follow, usually people that I follow on Twitter are fellow comics, and most comics tweet depressing stuff because it's just, it's their nature, I think. And so it doesn't feel like I'm being an exhibitionist. It feels like I'm just being honest, you know? The worst thing about Twitter is there are people who clearly are leading good, well-adjusted lives, and they have a lot of industry heat on them, and they have a house, and they have a wife, and they're doing very well financially, yet they're still tweeting about, oh, I'm eating Arby's at 2 in the morning. I'm like, no, you're not. You're just saying that because you want people to think you're that guy. Those are the people that I'll unfollow, you know, after a while. But it's the people that I follow on Twitter are usually the honest ones that I can tell are truly in a certain amount of despair, and they're using comedy as a way to, and I admire that. And I usually follow people who are like that.
You know, my feeling,
because I think it's a healthy way to do. I think it's healthier to do that than it is to just sit in your apartment writing a 20-page diary in your own blood, you know, about how sad you are, or tweeting about your cats or something. It's like, I want to hear, you know, that you use your humor to combat the depression. That's pretty gutsy. I like that.
I've discovered that it's okay for me to do that stuff as long as that's not the sole way that I'm expressing what I'm feeling, that it's okay to do it in addition to talking to my friends in support groups, going to therapy, you know, doing all the other stuff that I have to do on a daily basis, then it's okay. But I find if I'm slacking off on those things and I'm trying to connect through solely through Twitter or Facebook, that it just makes the emptiness worse for me because it's a pseudo connection as opposed to...
It definitely is. Yeah. Definitely is. I mean, and I think you have more outlets though than I do. You have a podcast. You said you had a group thing you do. For me, I don't have a podcast. It's really just Twitter and Facebook, and that's pretty much it. And I don't have a ton of friends. I have a couple, but I don't have like tons and tons of friends, and I'm not going to bars and opening up to, you know, about my life to some girl in a black miniskirt, you know, drinking skinny vodka, you know? So it's just not like that.
Are there any...
Skinny girl vodka. I want to apologize for Bethany for not using the girl in her brand. That's Bethany.
She has the skinny girl line.
Yeah, she's she's this woman who somehow has been able to build this giant brand of vodka off of her ridiculous reality TV show.
Well,
career.
It's brilliant combining the popularity of alcoholism with anorexia.
Yeah, exactly. She's been able to, you know, capture that market. Yeah. You know, that's a great demographic to have, I guess, you know?
Jen Kirkman had a really funny tweet where she said, I salute necrophiliacs for efficiently combining the things we think about every 3 minutes.
Okay.
I'm kind of paraphrasing it, but there was a thought that I had. I was asking, are there any behaviors that feel addictive or compulsive to you?
Yeah.
That you sometimes?
My working out. I think it's compulsive. And I think I feel like if I don't work out on a day, if I don't work out in the morning, I usually feel like shit during that whole day. I feel guilty and I feel like fat, and I just feel like I should have done something, you know? Working out for me is it's very important because, again, it chases the blues away. But it's just something that I need. I need to sweat every day in some way.
Well,
it's something that I do. But you know what? Of all the compulsions that are out there, that's not a bad one to have.
Is that not healthy though? I mean, do you push yourself to the point of vomiting? Or
no? But I push my. I mean, I'll go to Griffith Park on an August afternoon when it's 120 degrees out there, and I will run for 5 miles, and I don't care. I just will go. I don't have any water with me. I'll just go. I don't care. So I think is it unhealthy? No, because I'm in very good shape. And so I don't feel at all unsafe about going out there.
It's not coming from a place of punishing. It's coming from a place of wanting to feel better.
I think it's definitely the pun, but it's a good punishment. There's nothing better, I think, and more euphoric than after you've completed a really heavy, hard run or workout. And there's that moment when you're in your apartment after you've showered and you're just kind of laying there and you feel so euphoric. It's a thousand times more of a better feeling than Lexapro or any antidepressant could ever do.
What would the difference be between pushing yourself as an athlete and punishing yourself as somebody who is battling a sickness? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'm just
I bet there have been times when I punished myself physically because I was in a horrible place and I didn't feel like I deserved any sort of, you know, I guess I didn't feel like my body deserved being taken care of. So I wanted to break it down a little bit and showed who's boss. So I would go out and do horribly long runs and lift way too much weight and do things just to punish it, to make it hurt a little bit, just to feel some pain, feel something. But I don't think I did that a lot. I think mainly my exercising is to get that euphoric feeling.
We should mention too that you work out with a ball gag.
Yeah, exactly. With a ball gag.
And you have you have the gimp spot you.
I am led around by a collar and leash, walking around yelling out mommy, mommy as I run through Griffith Park. Jesus. We'll save that for our second podcast, for part two of the podcast, you know?
is there anything else that you'd like to share? Any seminal moments? I mean, you've certainly shared.
I think the being held back and the bike accident are really two very seminal moments in my life that I've not shared with anybody. So those are the two things, though. Are you disappointed? Do you think you're hoping I had more?
No.
Okay.
No, I like the one thing I fear this podcast becoming is, for lack of a better analogy, but it Jerry Springer like in in that it's not about how dramatic somebody's story is, but I also know sometimes that there's something really compelling about the dramatic story. So I certainly love those when I get one that is like that. But the reason I started this podcast is to help people feel less alone and see all the camouflage that the darkness presents itself in.
Sure.
So if I can have somebody like you come and share a story where it's not the typical, my uncle fucked me, my dad told me I was a piece of shit, I got pushed down the stairs.
Yeah.
If I can take a break from those stories and have somebody whose struggle is every bit as real, but it comes from something different.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. So it's great. I'm glad that your story isn't,
a cliche in a lot of ways,
Yeah. But you know, I don't want to put down the people that have those stories. I just worry sometimes about the show becoming repetitive or stereotyped.
I don't think it is, because I think everyone you talk to eventually, I mean, I just think they're all going to have their own ways of arriving at that sad place. You know, everyone has a different route that they took. Mm-hmm. I've listened to a lot of your podcasts and rarely have I heard the same stories. It's like depression's like a snowflake, you know? It's like everybody is just different getting to theirs, you know?
Absolutely. And
that was really nice, by the way. Depression is like a snowflake.
Oh, I agree.
I'm going to put that on a Hallmark card.
And I just want to say again to anybody out there that doesn't have something in their life that they can point to explain why they're feeling the way they're feeling, it's okay. It doesn't matter. That's not important.
Yeah.
Give weight to what it is that you're feeling and open that window and
don't jump, though.
Ask for help. But don't,
I thought don't that's jump. Where you were going for a second.
Yeah. Open that window.
He told me to just go open the window. I live on an 18th floor.
Fling your worthless ass.
And I haven't worked in 3 months, you son of a... Oh, God.
And sometimes I think parental indifference can be something that can be every bit as damaging as overt abuse. Absolutely. And that's one of the most difficult things to for people to identify. But even if there's nothing, even if there was parental support and there's still that stuff, just keep moving forward and reaching out and asking for help, because we're not going to have epiphany sitting in the Lazy Boy watching a Law and Order marathon.
Are you plagiarizing one of Jerry Springer's final thoughts? Because that sounds very familiar. I feel like you're doing something that I've heard before. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I hope not, because I've lost all respect for you.
I'm about to have the audience start booing,
throwing
at you
chairs,
and yelling,
and you know,
and somebody's going to attack you, and then a big overweight guard, a security guard, is going to intercept them, and we're going to cut to a commercial.
Oh, God. Okay. See Kyle. White power.
No. Matt, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your life. I really
appreciate
it.
Thank you for having me, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Many, many thanks to Matt. I really, really enjoyed talking to him.
Before we take it out with some surveys and emails, I want to remind you there's a couple of different ways to support the show if you feel so inclined. Go to the website, mentalpod.com. And MetalPod is also the Twitter handle you can follow me at if you're on Twitter. But go to MetalPod.com, and you can make either a one-time PayPal donation, which I love, or a recurring monthly donation, which I really love, because it provides some financial footing to keep the show going, and we can always use more donors, because people do drop off from the show. They either get burnt out from my bullshit, or they, you know, for whatever reason, people do stray away from the show and they stop donating. And so it's kind of like this thing that we constantly need people to replace those that that stop donating. So it's super easy. Go to the website and you can sign up for as little as $5 a month, and you don't have to worry about it unless you decide you want to cancel or your credit card expires. And it's super simple to do either of those. You can also support us by shopping at Amazon through our search portal. It's on our homepage, right-hand side, about halfway down. And just make sure your ad blocker isn't on, because it might not show up if your ad blocker is engaged. And you can support us non-financially by going to iTunes, writing something nice about us, giving us a good rating. That boosts our ranking and brings more people to the show. Because when we do show up on iTunes front page, we get more listeners. So it kind of feeds on itself. It's kind of like the good Ebola. Yeah, that's the analogy I was looking for. And you can support us non-financially by spreading the word through social media. I really, really appreciate those of you that do that. That's a big part of keeping the listenership sustained. Enough of my yakking. Let's get to you guys. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Zork8871. And his awfulsome moment is, and for those of you that are new to the show, an awfulsome moment is a moment that was awful at the time, but in hindsight, has an element that's kind of awesome, or at least darkly funny to it. This is kind of a light one, but I met my current girlfriend when we were both 16 and hit it off pretty quickly. I was over to her house one day and feeling hungry, so I decided to order a stuffed crust pizza from Pizza Hut. I love how he described what the pizza was. I had almost enough cash to pay for it, but was $2 short. I remember seeing a $2 bill in a jar on my girlfriend's bookshelf. What possessed me to use it on the pizza order, I do not know, but in the end, I paid for it and quickly forgot about it. A couple of weeks later, my girlfriend's grandfather, who had been ill for many years at that point, passed away. After the funeral, we went over to her house again, and she started to show me some relics he had bequeathed her. She swore he had given her a $2 bill that she had stashed in a jar on her bookshelf. I confessed. To this day, I feel she has not really forgiven me, though we were able to kind of laugh about it when it comes up from time to time. Oh, I love that. This is an email I got from a woman who wants to be called. She says, you can refer to me as "this isn't an emergency, but," because she says that gets, she's a 911 dispatcher, and she says that gets said on 911 all the time. And her email says, hi, Paul, I'm a newish listener. Started listening after I first heard you on Crab Feast. That is the podcast that my guest, Ryan Sickler, co-hosts. And she writes, I need a bit of help. I'm a police dispatcher in my hometown for about 5 months, and I'm having a hard time dealing with some of the stress. As terrible as some of the 911 calls can be, I've taught myself how to handle those, but I can't seem to handle the radio traffic. When it gets busy or there's a, quote, hot call, or if someone gets in a pursuit, I freeze. I imagine it's similar to a panic attack. My hands start to violently shake, I can't breathe, and I start to break down. It sounds like a panic attack to me. Can you point me in the direction as to what I might be able to do to keep me calm when things go crazy? What do people do during panic attacks? I need to keep myself together because I like my job. As frustrating as it can be, I like being able to help people in this way. Are there any episodes with a dispatcher I might be able to steer myself to? I haven't done one with a dispatcher, but I would love to. I have done one with a policeman. It's called Policeman Andy. Anyways, I wrote her back and I said, thank you so much for your email. I can't imagine how hard it must be to have a panic attack on a job like that. Since your questions feel like they should be addressed by someone with more expertise than me, I'm going to CC a couple of people. And the first therapist that got back to me was Erica Holmes, who was a guest we had a couple of episodes back. And she writes, first thing is to recognize it as a panic attack and label it as such. Panic attacks are scary, but they aren't dangerous. Panic attacks gain momentum when experienced as dangerous themselves, i.e. I'm losing control, I can't breathe, I'm having a heart attack, etc. Panic attacks suck, but they aren't dangerous. I know I'm repeating, but it bears repeating. During a panic attack, best to breathe deeply into the belly, feel feet on ground, look around and notice safe environment, remind self you're safe, and panic attack will be over soon. I do some self-talk and validate the stress of the job and remind myself I'm safe. I was just thinking how ironic that would be if while having a client pour their guts out to her, she had a panic attack. She just stands up and starts breathing deeply, feeling her feet on the ground. Go ahead, continue. Talk about your childhood trauma. I'm just going to breathe deeply. She also writes, maybe talk to coworkers about how they deal. Maybe some visualization of self being calm and confident at work. Also, some acceptance around stress of job and limits of ability to help everyone or control others slash prevent tragedy, etc. This is where a therapist could be helpful, as there may be deeper issues at play. It's a process. Nothing will help overnight, but repeat exposure to stress and mindfulness that she's safe will help. Thank you so much for that, Erica. And the woman wrote me back, and she thought that that stuff was very, very helpful. I love that when I'm able to give somebody a little something. Kind of like the Italian guys in the casinos in the 50s. They'd roll up a $5 bill. Go get yourself a little something nice. This is an awfulsome moment. We had a nice flood of awfulsome moments filled out this last week. Made me very, very happy. I was on Kara Santa Maria's podcast, and I think I did a call to action for people to fill out happy moments and awfulsome moments. Anyways, this one was filled out by Mary, and she writes, my mother was in bed dying. She had maybe a day or two to live and was comfortably sleeping most of the time with morphine injections. I was planning her coffin. I had arranged for lots of her favorite newspapers and a shredder for a soft blanket and a soft blanket for her to lie on. Friends were writing notes and collecting pictures to be put in with her. I was to put the coffin in the back of my station wagon and drive her to the crematorium a certain number of hours after her death. So the coffin had to fit her body and my car. I've never heard of somebody driving the coffin themselves, but maybe that's done in smaller towns or something. Or it's kind of a do-it-yourself thing. Anyway, finally, she was deeply asleep as I pulled out my sewing tape and measured her dimensions. I was at her shoulders when she popped open her eyes, looked me square in the eye, and said, measuring me for my coffin? I froze, not quite knowing the proper response, and feeling if I didn't move, maybe I was invisible. A couple of seconds later, she closed her eyes and went back to her drugged sleep. For your information, I did have to put a pillow under her knees to make her a little shorter to fit the coffin to fit the car. I'm sure she had a comfy ride, and yes, she was in the house for a day after her death, so lots of time to, quote, talk and adjust to the fact that I no longer had a mom. We were very close. I moved in with her for last 1.5 years, and it was the best thing I've ever done. She talked about all kinds of things. She remembered her childhood. She told her secrets. We laughed and cried. It was a sacred time. Paul, my mom is not your mom. You are doing the right thing with your mom. I totally support you. Lots of love. Thank you for that. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Mega Man. And he writes, oh no, I'm sorry. This is a woman who calls herself Mega Man. And she writes, I once let a man pay me for sex, or at least I thought that's what I was agreeing to. He took me to a hotel, and while he was nice and tried to make me feel comfortable, I didn't feel comfortable at all. He had me get naked and on all fours, and he started sticking his dick between my butt crack, like having it jack him off. He did this for a few minutes and then came on my back. I was so confused, and then he said, I forgot a condom, and then he gave me $200. I'm not even going to comment on that one. There's some that just speak for itself. This is a being hospitalized survey, and this was filled out by a woman who calls herself Kim. And the reason she was hospitalized, when I was 19, I became addicted to Adderall, and after several months of addiction, had a psychotic episode. After weeks in the hospital, I became so depressed that I started taking Adderall again, became psychotic a second time, and was hospitalized for weeks again. How was your experience? It was horrifying. No one tried to talk to me or understand my delusions. I didn't understand where I was or what was wrong with me. I thought I was going to be trapped forever. I thought I had contracted a lethal STD from a guy that raped me months before the first hospitalization, and that was why I was going crazy and being quarantined. They had to give me a shot in my ass as a sedative the first night, and I thought I was being euthanized. At 19, I had never heard of mania, and no one explained to me that I was manic for the weeks I spent in the hospital the first time. I was treated like an idiot when, in fact, I'm very bright. I have 2 master's degrees and teach humanities and philosophy courses at the college level. I remember my parents brought pictures of me and my family to put in my room, and the nurses gathered around and looked at them without bothering to ask me who the pictures were of, etc. They were fascinated to see what I was like when I wasn't, quote, crazy. I overheard the nurses complaining that my parents were annoying them with questions about me all the time. I got fed up and called my parents and told them that the nurses are a bunch of assholes who think I'm a non-human animal. They were shocked and then told me I must be depressed and asked the doctor to put me on an antidepressant as well. I was so heavily medicated, I remember my eyes would shake and seizure, but I didn't tell anyone because I thought I was there to die anyways and that the seizures were just a new stage in my lethal STD. Wow, that is heavy. That is heavy. Thank you for that, Kim. This is a awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Neglected Pocket Pussy. That's right. Love the names you guys come up with. He writes, and this is more of an awfulsome day than an awfulsome moment. And he writes, it was a sunny day, so I decided to wear loose joggies and a t-shirt. When I got outside, I realized it was chilly, but decided against putting a jacket on. Anyway, I had an anxiety attack in the lecture theater at college and had to walk from the top and back of the lecture theater down to the front, passing about 150 students and the lecturer, who I blatantly ignored when he called me to ask where I was going. I walked straight outside and noticed the sun was gone, and moments later it started to rain. Now, wishing I'd worn my jacket and having decided it was too shit of a day and too awkward to go back to class, I went to therapy a few hours early and just waited outside the building. Whilst waiting there, I love anybody who uses the word whilst. I think he's English. Whilst waiting there, I got drenched in water by a bus which drove through a huge puddle at the side of the road. I slowly slid down onto the ground, soaking wet, alone, cold, tired, and hungry. I had no money other than the money to pay my therapist, and there were no buildings nearby that I could just sit in to wait. About 30 minutes before therapy was due to begin, the police arrived and told me to get up and leave the area, insisting I was making the place looking dirty. So I got up and off I went. I finally came back and went into the building, still soaked to the bone and shaking from the cold. He writes, a -5 Celsius. Yeah, so I'm sure it's probably either Canada or... like, doing detective work about where this is from as if it has any bearing on this. Anyway, we do need to know where the word whilst comes from. I bumped into my therapist at the elevator. We got on the lift together. Yes, of course, he's English. And it was I'm annoying myself. We got on the lift together, and it was slightly awkward since I didn't know what to talk to her about other than doctor-patient talk. To make matters worse, and you won't believe this, the elevator broke between floors. So there I am, cold, wet, hungry, uncomfortable, claustrophobic, and stuck in an elevator having my weekly hour therapy session with my shrink. At the end of the session, which was actually 90 minutes due to being stuck so long, she didn't take my money. So I went and bought a huge triple bacon and cheeseburger with fries and a Coke and went to the cinema to see a movie called Side Effects. Got some popcorn, enjoyed the rest of the week. Thank you for that. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Doug. And he writes, while trying to find the right meds for my OCD / depression. We discovered that when I take Zoloft, I react in what's called dystonia, which is an uncontrollable convulsing. It's essentially restless legs all over my body. It was horrible. I would flop around on the ground, sometimes getting rug burns on my forehead. I remember, I'm sure that a lot of people believe you, how'd you get the rug burn on your forehead? Dystonia. Oh yeah, is that his name? Because of the dystonia, I had to miss over a month of work. So for the months of June and July, I stayed home with my wife. The moments I wasn't shaking were great. We just sat there watching terrible movies and TV. I fell in love with her even more. It's the longest we were together without being apart. I have since had my meds change and everything is good now. But I thank the Zoloft and dystonia for giving me and my wife a summer vacation-ish. Thank you for that. And then I wanted to read this email because I feel like it's good follow-up to that. This is from a guy who refers to himself as Bart, and he sent me this email. Dear Paul, after listening to the latest episode of your podcast with Aparna Nancherla, I felt like I wanted to ask you something. Is there any chance you could talk a little bit more about medication and what it does exactly? Maybe with a psychiatrist who can talk about the exact workings of the different medications and what this means for a person in daily life, but also with some guests who have taken medication that could maybe shed some more light on what the differences before and after were and what changed for them. As someone who is in the process of deciding, I have in the past talked about that with, but maybe not as in depth, and I was supposed to record a psychiatrist to come on and talk about areas that psychiatrists work in that therapists don't because they don't have an MD, but his schedule changed and we weren't able to do it. Continuing, as someone who was in the process of deciding whether I should start taking Lexapro for my anxiety and depression issues, I would very much like to hear from people who have used meds and benefited from it clearly. And then he just kind of goes on to talk about how scared he is, and he's afraid that, for instance, he writes, Aparna mentioned her using Lexapro, but then continue to talk about all the issues she's still struggling with. And then that becomes part of my inner monologue about how it's only a temporary numbing of the problems like the other drugs are. And, you know, to that, I say that meds don't fix us, but meds give us a chance to heal. Because for some of us, if there's an underlying chemical imbalance, for lack of a better word, healing is almost impossible. But oftentimes there's a chemical imbalance and there's a trauma or a lack of coping mechanism. So it dissatisfaction, unhappiness, anxiety, all of these things need to be handled on multi-tiered fronts. And meds are just one of them. They don't make you happy. They give you a chance to be happy. And as Matt said in this episode, it gives him the vigor to get out and face the world. So, and it's a hit and miss thing. Every person reacts a little bit differently to meds. So you might have a bad reaction to it, but the good news is you can stop if you choose to. And hopefully you'll have a good shrink that will welcome your feedback and be accessible and easy to talk to. I hope that helped. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Linz, L-I-N-D-S, and she writes, with today being the anniversary of 9/11, I was reflecting on where I was when the planes hit 13 years ago. I was a junior in high school, and I was at home with my mom getting ready for school and work. We always watched the Today Show, so we saw the TV coverage from the first moment and were standing aghast when we watched the second plane hit in real time. The Today Show immediately started replaying the impact of the second plane, but in her shock, my mom thought each replay was a new plane. She was counting and becoming more hysterical with each replay. A third just hit. A fourth. A fifth. Six planes. She got to seven before I started laughing and pointed out it was the same plane. It was an awful event and a surreal day, but I always appreciated the quick moment that she gave us to step back from the intensity. I usually feel like an awful person for having a small chuckle over such a horrific event. So thanks for at least giving the sentiment a cool name. that I hate laughing at anything that is 9/11 related, but that is clearly not related at, you know, not pointed at the victims. I have a friend who was so addicted to having sex with his girlfriend and so afraid that she was not going to have sex with him on any given day. He woke up on the morning of 9/11. He went out to get some cigarettes. When he was at the convenience store, he saw on the TV what happened. And he knew when he went back, if he told his girlfriend what had happened, she obviously wouldn't feel like having sex. And so he pretended it didn't happen. And when it came on the news, he had to pretend like he saw it for the first time, which ironically was then done in an episode of Mad Men. So maybe he's not the first person that's done something like that, but he was pretty ashamed. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Darkly Optimistic. And she writes, "When my ex-husband and I were first living together in our very early 20s and poor, I made him a big sand candle for his birthday." I'd never heard of a sand candle. A few nights later, in an effort to be romantic after a fight we had, he lit the candle on his nightstand and we began to have makeup sex. The problem with sand candles, especially homemade ones, is they are often not perfectly flat on the bottom. Mine was rather rounded. As we were really getting into it in his into his bed, his bed, which was a mattress on box springs on the floor, started to rhythmically bump into the nightstand, and this made the sand candle start rocking, unbeknownst to us. Not whilst. Right as I started to achieve orgasm, I opened my eyes and saw that he had gotten too close to the rocking candle and his mid-back length curly hair had caught fire. As you can imagine, I screamed in a panic. I couldn't get the words out to tell him what was the matter for what seemed like forever. Although I was terrified and very worried about him, I was also in the throes of an orgasm, and the fear and excitement of that moment somehow intensified my orgasm. I just couldn't talk. I finally got out the words, "Your hair, it's on fire," which for some really bizarre reason made him very angry at me, but made him just fuck me even harder while growling and slapping his hair out. It was simultaneously the most intensely thrilling and upsetting slash confusing sexual experience I have ever had. As soon as we had both came or come, a whole new argument started over my overreaction to opening my eyes with seeing the man who was fucking me with his hair on fire. As pissed off and hurt as I was about his anger with my reaction, the only thing I could really think about was how fucking amazing the resulting orgasm had been. You can't make that shit up. That is great. And then finally, this is just a sweet little sublime happy moment from a guy who calls himself Cleveland Dave. And I know some of you guys have submitted happy moments that are kind of bigger and more dramatic, but for some reason, the ones that really touch me are the ones that are more sublime and subtle. And I think the reason I like these more is because they are more indicative when I experience them that I'm in a good place. And so that's why they resonate so deeply with me when I read one. And he writes, "It was a cool night at the end of summer this year, and I decided to take one of my dogs for a walk. As my 70-pound lab, Hunter, started barking from sheer happiness and jumping on anything that would hold his weight and some things that wouldn't, I noticed that my other lab, Coco, who was 16 years old, had gotten herself up to see what all the commotion was. Although she couldn't see or hear well, she put together that I was taking the other dog for a walk, and with what little energy she had, she too started barking at me, begging me to take her as well. Feeling awful, knowing that Coco couldn't walk very well anymore, I decided to load both dogs up into the car and take them to a park a few blocks away. I let the dogs out, and the younger one bounded out, running through the field, exploring what he could explore, sniffing what he could sniff, and rolling in whatever gross stuff he found to roll in. I walked slowly so Coco could keep up with me, and she found a tree on a hill that she seemed to like and plopped herself down under it. I sat there as the last light was leaving the sky and the lightning bugs were coming out, and watching my two greatest friends experience two separate things. One, running around, taking in everything he could, eating the fireflies, running in circles, and barking at his own shadow, while the other, just content to lay under a tree as I rubbed her ears. It was a wonderful evening, just spent at the park, hanging out with my two puppies. Ah, love that. Love that. Want to also remind you, if you're going to be in the LA area, September 26th, that's a week from tonight, I'm doing a live taping of the podcast at LA Podfest. I record at 7 o'clock that night, and it's Podfest is at the Hotel Sofitel in West Hollywood. And I believe weekend passes are still available for that. And if you aren't going to be in the LA area, you can still watch it because they're going to video stream it. And passes are $25 to see any video of any podcast being recorded. And there's going to be dozens recorded that weekend. And you can watch it up to 3 weeks, either watch it live or up to 3 weeks after it records, and you get $5 off the pass if you enter the offer code GILMARTIN when you purchase it. And the link to go to purchase that is lapodfest.com/live. And again, use the offer code GILMARTIN and you get $5 off that $25. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. My guest is Laura House, who's a funny, sweet person, and has a lot of experience with meditation, not only doing it, but also teaching it. And I think we're going to get into that, hopefully in a way that isn't too dry. Because I know meditation is not the most exciting thing to talk about. But anyway, I'm really looking forward to recording her and doing PodFest and meeting you guys, seeing you in person. It's always nice to connect with the listeners, or the little people, as I call them, when I walk around and have my butler bring me things. Anyway, I hope tonight's episode gave you something, maybe comfort, maybe insight, maybe just a distraction from something you don't want to feel or think about. I know for me, that's a lot of times what I look for, is something to just take me away. And I hope if you've been having trouble asking for help, I hope tonight's episode brought you a little closer to being able to reach out for help. And just know that you're not alone, and thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely.